welcome to WNHH FM's Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look. Join me on an exploration of what makes the Elm City tick. We are taking a break from the Great Give Radiothon to talk to a very special guest who's visiting our city today. His name is Jonathan Lerner. He's come to town to promote a new memoir, which I just read. It's just published. It's called Swords in the Hands of Children, Reflections of an American Revolutionary. It's about his time on the front lines of the radical political army calling itself Weatherman. He's here in the WNHH studio to tell us about that. Welcome, Jonathan. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
So last night, I believe you gave a reading and a speech at the Institute Library. How'd that go?
It was like a lot of the things I've been doing, it attracted a lot of people of my own generation, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm.
We had a really good conversation. The Institute Library is a great institution,
it
by
is.
The way.
It's really fun.
Yeah. And something that most communities don't have.
Okay. Well, Jonathan, you've written this memoir about being part of the radical group Weatherman, which grew out of Students for a Democratic Society in the 1960s. And you originally tried writing this book in 1989, your personal memoir, and you do bring a new perspective to this. Why now? What changed in the writing that you didn't end up publishing a book in 1989, but you do have this very interesting tale to tell in 2018? What changed?
Well, the story hasn't changed. What changed is that I'm a better writer. In 1989, I was asked by a publisher to write this story, and I didn't yet understand the difference between memoir and history. I was trying to do them both. I did a lot of research in archives. I went and interviewed a lot of ex-comrades, and I thought I could tell the complete history and tell my own story. But not that much time had elapsed since the end of the experience. I wasn't really clear about my own thoughts about it. And it was a terrible book, and I'm delighted that it wasn't published. And then
so much good writing needs another draft.
Yeah, really, it's true.
What is the difference between memoir and history?
Well, there's no hard facts. You know, everything is received information, and history is often in dispute. But I think if you're a historian, you are trying very hard to triangulate and draw from source material, and when you're writing memoir, the source material is yourself.
It's a
personal story, and it's, you know, I knew when I wrote this memoir, when I finally understood how to write memoir, that there were going to be people who would read it and think that they had a completely different experience of the same event, or I was wrong about something, and you know what? Like, this is my memory. Memory is famously malleable and fallible, so it's my story. It's a personal story.
So, and I got that from reading it, Jonathan, that you were in a different place in your life and it'd be able to tell the story maybe more completely with both a little more distance, but also a little more perspective from having lived another 20 years. Also, what's different about telling this story in 2018 about a radical political movement that believed it was on the front lines of revolution at a time when it believed that our American political system was so broken, so violent and corrupt, that only an underground movement aimed at overthrowing it and committing violence in the process, including killing people. What is the value of telling that story now? How does it resonate in 2018? How's it relevant?
A lot of people are justifiably outraged and admirably motivated to become activists today. In some ways, it really feels like the late 60s. And the reason I wanted to tell the story now is that I feel that I have a few things to say to people, especially new, inexperienced activists, about mistakes not to make. There's a few lessons I've learned. And I would like to encourage the most creative possible activism today, and that's why I told the story.
Before we're going to get into details of some of the lessons you take about what to do and not do. Is there any quick one? Maybe something with violence?
Well, the basic message that I want to impart is think for yourself. Don't do things because the people you want to be friends with are suggesting you do it.
Which is a big power. That's really under-recognized sometimes.
You bet. That was a lot of what motivated me to make the decisions I made back then. Think for yourself. Don't abandon your ability to critically judge what's going on. Make your own decisions.
It's actually one reason I've never really been an activist. Toyed with it in college, and I always wanted to disagree with myself or the people I'm with. That's why I thought I should be a journalist instead. Yeah. Uh-huh. You know, but I was a respected activist who feel strongly that they have a vision for what can be good. But you got it requires a degree of humility as well.
I think so, and intelligence,
and not demonizing the people you don't agree with.
Right.
The one that always got me was calling cops pigs. I always thought you had so many people in movements like yours who came from privileged backgrounds and said they were against classism and yet dehumanized working class people who did jobs that more privileged people didn't want to do, which was protecting people from crime and calling them pigs. I always felt that was not only to help you lose the country's support, it was kind of mean.
It was kind of mean, yeah. And it's, you know, one thing that I feel very differently about now is that I don't see a value in creating polarization. I think we have plenty of polarization now. And so acting hostily or speaking provocatively when it's just in the service of defining a difference between you and me, where does that go?
And yet there's a need to crusade for justice.
You bet.
And you picked up on that when you were in college in the 1960s. You joined a group called Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. They issued the Port Huron Statement, What They Believe, which I recommend reading because I think it resonates well today. At some point after the assassinations, I believe, of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy and the riots in the streets and the kind of hangover from the heady days of the early civil rights movement when people realized the change wasn't coming as deep and fast as we thought it should and that American society was resisting in a big way, SDS morphed into a group called by various names, Weatherman, The Weathermen, The Weather Underground, and you were there from the beginning.
I was there.
How did you get caught up in that?
My motivation was about morality, not so much about ideology. Actually, my first political acts had been in junior high school when I joined integration rallies during
with
the
your
civil
parents and your father was a foreign service
my father was a foreign service officer but no actually just by myself the very first one I just got on a bus and went downtown to a picket line
in DC
that was trying to integrate an apartment complex.
Mm-hmm.
And
that must have been not because when we're young we see things often in a Manichaean way of right and wrong, good and bad, but it does seem like, and we're talking early to mid 60s, right, and that time it was really true. There really was a right side and a wrong side when you're talking about integration and civil rights.
Well, I mean, the civil rights movement is, the morality of the civil rights movement is unassailable.
That's one of the few things we look in history. I mean, you could look at individual solutions and talk about what are the pluses and minuses. You could look at Booker T. Washington versus W.E.B. Du Bois, and while it's not always that their positions are opposite, they have different approaches that you can argue about self-empowerment versus integration. But no one could deny that you're picketing apartment buildings shouldn't be keeping black people out, or, you know.
Yeah, and as a young kid, as a 13-year-old, I was really moved by that, and that was the start. But then, you know, the years went on. I was a hippie. It was the counterculture. I was against the war as the war became
Vietnam War
as it became the more sort of central political fact. I wasn't really drawn into radical politics in terms of ideology. I was drawn in out of a sense of frustration and a sense of wanting to act, wanting to do something. And I was drawn in by my personal relationships with some people who were much more politically involved than I was.
And I think you're taking me post when you left, dropped out of college and went to New York, right?
Yeah.
You had friends who were in SDS.
Right.
Before that, I really love a scene I found so interesting when you were at Antioch in 1967. You talked about your first action against the Vietnam War, and you got a lifelike dummy that you set aside. You were inspired by the Buddhist who burned himself to death to protest the Vietnam War that had been seen around the world, and it's recently been back in the news.
Mm-hmm.
And you, and I was just wondering if you would like to read us from pages 12 to 16. I've marked off the pages in your book.
Sure.
Because we're going to talk, we talked about lessons here. We talked about what we can learn today from what happened with you, Jonathan Lerner, when you were a member of SDS and then the Weather Underground in the 1960s, and you're listening to Jonathan Lerner talk about his new book, Swords in the Hands of Children, Reflections of an American Revolutionary, here on Dateline New Haven on WNHH-FM. Jonathan is going to read a scene from the book from 1967.
This bit of theater had the desired effect of generating buzz about the war and the mobilization. The next issue of the College Weekly was full of it. I had thought of what we did as a cri de coeur, a testament, something like Picasso's Guernica. I think I had foolishly expected that every person's feelings would mirror mine, so I was surprised to discover that not everyone had been moved to empathy, let alone action. Some people felt attacked and angry at us, not at what we called the war machine. The argument seemed ludicrous. We had no right to disrupt the dinner hour with something so unpleasant.
Oh, yeah, let me just interrupt you, because what happened was they were eating dinner, and you set this dummy on fire. It looked like it was a real person. And because it was all over the news about the Buddhist monk in Vietnam who killed himself, someone thought someone had just lit himself on fire.
That was the point.
And the fire department came and put it out.
Yeah. And it disrupted the dinner hour. Yeah. Of the entire college was sitting in the dining hall. I'm not sure anyone actually put it that simplistically. If I misheard at the time deliberately or misremember now, then I concede that it belittles our critics to reduce their opinions to the proclamation of a breach of etiquette. Maybe those who didn't like our action had something more nuanced to contribute. Maybe they wanted dialogue. I still think this action was brilliant for its clarity and punch. Property damage was limited to a scorch on the asphalt. Nobody was physically hurt, although many were shocked and upset. I said it was calculated to provoke. Emotional reaction was the deliberate goal. Shock is one way to get through to people. Grief often accompanies new awareness of a great wrong, and conversely, anger can accompany its denial. It sometimes takes a shock to move people to action. We had not provoked a confrontation with any entity of officialdom except the fire brigade who grumbled, but were merely other powerless students like ourselves. Our intended audience, our target, was not in this case the warmongering government. We were trying to affect our peers, not the country's policies. And let me just say, we were specifically trying to mobilize the student body to get on chartered buses and come to a big national demonstration in New York that was coming up the next week. Nowadays, doing something like this on the campus of a liberal arts college might be found objectionable for not being preceded by a trigger warning. Of course, its success was based on surprise and the manipulation of sensitivities, as is all effective theater. Regarding our rude despoliation of dinner time, my feelings today are more convoluted. I quite value my domestic routines. Now, dinner being an important one in my daily scheme of things, usually I have cooked it and gone to some effort. Peter and I use cloth napkins. We often light candles and put on relaxing music. I make a point of not looking at my phone while I'm at the table, on the theory that nothing could be so urgent that it can't wait a few minutes, and that the benefit of an uninterrupted meal with my husband surpasses that of any instantaneously delivered particle of new information. More generally, I ration my intake of current events, and pretty much the only social media I pay attention to is a Facebook community page for the small city where we live, on which announcements of yard sales, lost cats, and road closures dominate. These are protective tactics I have settled on to keep myself sane in an assaultive world. I may be less resilient than I was when young, or even less open-minded, or maybe I'm just less hungry for a constant feed of outrages, since I've long ago learned that when it can't get any worse, it will.
Mm-hmm.
I'm certainly less reactive, by which I mean less hot-headed, and definitely less hungry for a fight. I'm almost always aware that my energy is finite. I practice conservation.
I find that so interesting, and that's from Jonathan Litter's book, Swords in the Hands of Children, about his time in the weather underground. And you, I guess, were 18 or 19, you did that mm-hmm. demonstration. I love the dinner part.
Uh-huh.
So you're looking back, you always say, how much should we disrupt people? So if you're consumed with fury about injustice and you want people to pay attention to something, to injustice, excuse me, and you feel you have a reason to disrupt it. As you mentioned, this is a case where no one got hurt, although they did call, I think, the firefighters pigs or something,
fascist, the word I used.
Yeah, but do you think that people have a right not to be disturbed at their dinner or their daily life? And the reason I'm asking you this is that when Donald Trump was elected, people had a real sense of urgency here in New Haven, and everyone wanted to demonstrate. There was one group that demonstrated a couple times a week, and they would always block traffic at rush hour. It would cost us thousands of dollars a day in money we don't have in the city to police it. But we also felt our city government and the police force, it's important to protect the First Amendment. But at some point, people said, how much are you supposed to disrupt? They said, we need to disrupt. You can't just go about your routines while Donald Trump is going to do all this terrible stuff to immigrants and civil rights. And other people, I remember riding the bus, working class people who definitely would agree with them and had no truck with no sympathy for Donald Trump, would say, I'm so mad at them every day. It's taking me an hour to get home on the bus, and I don't understand what that's doing. How do you see that in that light?
Well, I think these are really tricky questions because it's important to confront power. It's important to confront people who are ignoring important realities. But it's also important to find ways to do it that don't threaten people
and have the right target.
Yeah, it's partly the right target, and it's partly being so thoughtful enough about what the tactic you're planning to use.
And also
is.
When there's so much injustice, like how often do you do it? Does it have an effect? Like, for instance, did more people come on your chartered bus to the mobilization in Washington because of the effigy you burned or not?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question because I can't remember it. But when you talk about the weeks and months after the election and the inauguration, there seemed to be a demonstration every day. There was a resistance demonstration, however loosely defined resistance was. There was the women's demonstration. There were sanctuary cities actions. All of this was an expression of people's genuine feeling that they had to act, that there was things were sort of reaching a sort of crisis. On the other hand, the fact that there was kind of so much diffuse activity was very disturbing to me because I kept thinking, well, where does this go? I mean, who can actually go to a demonstration every day? Don't we also have lives? You have to practice conservation, as I said. You have to husband your energy.
And be strategic. Like the Women's March was a great thing. And we do have a record number of women running for office, some of whom were inspired by that march and coincided with Donald Trump's inauguration. But you have to wonder how many people are going to be active in campaigns and get people elected in the wake of that.
That's right, yeah. Strategy, like really, what is the end game? Where are you actually going with this? I think a good example of something maybe not very well formed and articulated yet, but is the high school students' movement for gun control.
That's been a great.
Because not only are they, again, like the civil rights movement, morally unassailable in what they're after, they're very focused. They're not trying to impeach the president. They're not, trying to do 15 other things. They're very focused on this one issue. It's a complex issue. They understand that it's going to be a long struggle. At least they understand it enough to say publicly things like, well, we're 16 now, but we're going to be 18 in 2 years and we'll be voting. They have a sense of a future and a goal, and I think that's really important, and it's missing from a lot of activism today.
Well, Jonathan Lerner, you've written a book here about your time in the 1960s when you were swept up in social movements for change. You dropped out of Antioch. You went to New York. You were an artist, right? You liked doing theater. And then you had friends who were in Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. Through them, you got involved, and you got really in the thick of it. You got on the staff. And then when SDS fell apart, as many groups splintered in America when things got tough and the government was coming down and they were fighting with each other, a group broke up called the Weather Underground or Weathermen, who would meet secretly within the group to fight others in the group. Those are some of my favorite scenes in the book. Mm-hmm. And you'd have a conference and you'd be plotting against each other who would have more time at the mic and who can vote. It's sort of like a synagogue when they say who gets to be president, who stacks the vote, or who they bring in. But anyway... you became part of Weather Underground, which is a very radical movement, saw themselves as revolutionaries and willing to use violence. And how did you get caught up in that? What was that like?
By the end of the 60s, and what we're talking about here is 1969, there was such a cascade of action and reaction and such an escalation of tension and conflict everywhere in the country that it seemed like a natural thing to do. It didn't feel like a break. It felt like the next logical step. Demonstrations against the war were not slowing the war down. Our objections to police repression of black militant organizations was not stopping the police repression. And we got to a point that I think some people may be reaching now too, which alarms me, that of thinking that there is nothing left to do but tear everything down, cause as much chaos as possible, try and pull the underpinnings out from under the country. And, I mean, we thought in a kind of deluded way that we actually could lead a revolution, literally a revolution.
And you were white. You were white and privileged for the most part, yeah. And you were allies of the Black Panther Party.
Yeah.
But you tried to plan that Days of Rage, it was called, in Chicago, and you thought all hell was going to break loose, and the government thought that too, and they were surveilling you and infiltrating you. But not many people showed up, but you still had sort of a rampage and broke a lot of stuff and got people arrested, right?
Yeah, we had this idea that the vehicle for revolution would be disaffected young white people, white working class people and white hippies and people who'd gotten in trouble for drugs and people who felt that they didn't have much future. And this was our idea. We were going to organize what we called a revolutionary youth movement. And so we called demonstrations in Chicago in October of 1969, where we, I guess we thought, because this is what we said to each other and to the press, that thousands of people were coming. There was going to be a chartered train coming from Detroit with thousands of kids. We were going to have 10,000 people in the street. I recently found in an archive that I myself was quoted in a daily newspaper in Chicago about a week before the demonstration, saying we would have between 5,000 and 10,000 people there. Actually, we had about 400 people there. It was basically ourselves and a few close friends of ours who got
But you believed along. You were organizing the revolution.
We did, yeah. And the sort of interesting thing about this is that when only this very tiny number of people showed up, and we had this very heavy series of confrontations with the police, and a lot of people got hurt and a lot of people got arrested, it was actually then, in that moment, that the leadership of Weatherman decided that we should be going underground. And in other words, well, if the masses of disaffected white kids aren't coming with us, we're just going to go do it alone ourselves.
And you had hidden identities and you moved to different kind of houses. That must have been kind of heady, kind of sort of.
It's very romantic, actually. It's like being in a movie.
And then you got drawn in partly. Now, you weren't there when people were getting heads cracked open, because they often had you be this person at the safe house, right, getting the information out.
And running the office and publishing the newspaper and raising bail money.
Did you feel guilty about that?
I felt guilty and I felt relieved, because I've always hated conflict, and the idea of actually having to go in the street and fight with cops always.
So you never actually killed anybody the way people in the Weather Underground?
I never killed anybody, and I was very rarely even in a street fight or even in a like physical confrontation.
But you were putting out the newspaper.
I was calling for all that activity.
And it was very interesting stuff you published, I thought. And you also were coordinating stuff. And in Chicago, one of the scenes I was very interested in was the relationship with the Black Panther Party. So the white radical groups kind of worship the Black Panther Party. They saw them as the vanguard of revolution. And you were in Chicago at a time when it was run by a guy named Fred Hampton, mm-hmm. who was murdered in his bed by the FBI. They came in, and the Chicago police, right? They came in and shot up the place while he was asleep with his lover, right?
Yes, and I think he'd been drugged, actually, too. A police agent.
And you knew Fred Hampton.
I didn't know him well, but I knew him, yeah.
And they used to come in your office. You have one very funny scene where they kind of hold you up. First of all, they're always telling you you're supposed to do their printing for free. Then at one point they came, they actually held you up at gunpoint.
It wasn't funny at the time. It made me funny.
What did it make you think about your relationship with them?
Well, it was really, really confusing, because we had sort of anointed them the vanguard of the revolution, and the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party had an office a few blocks down the street from us. We saw them frequently. Their office was a much sort of more a poorer, you know, smaller, less well-equipped than ours. So we had this kind of guilty relationship with them, where we tried to support them with printing, and often they couldn't pay us for it, and we did it anyway. But at the same time, they were really critical of us publicly. They thought we were. Fred Hampton gave press interviews calling us custeristic and suicidal.
And they're totally right.
Well, they were totally right, yeah. And I think that, you know, we had this idea that by provoking the cops, we were, and picking fights with the cops, we were drawing off some of the pressure on the black activists, that we were sort of helping dilute the ability of the cops to harass them. So when the Panthers criticized us, it was sort of impossible to understand, but then again, you know, maybe we weren't having that effect by causing those fights.
No, I've always felt so. For me, I did a book there. I did a lot of research in Black Panther Party about a murder here in New mm-hmm. Haven. And I always have two minds about the party. They had the same delusion you guys did, that they were going to be leading an armed revolution in the United States.
Right.
But I do think that they were kind of brilliant. Like, some of the ideas they had and their analysis of what was happening, and even down to like how crazy Weatherman was, was really on target. And yet I found, and they knew how to, and they also had, they really were not racist in any way. You know, they were saying that we want a black-led movement, because so much civil rights movement had been white people leading organizations telling black people what to do. But unlike the groups they fought with in the black nationalist movement, they did not believe that white people should be out. They said, if you want to help us, that's fine. But one way they got support, as I felt, was drawing on a racist notion that white people had about the quote-unquote true African-American. That was like, if they played up the violence and they got people off the street and called people pigs and everything, they kind of played up that this is the real, quote-unquote, a lot of stuff I read was like white radicals saying, these are the real black people. These are the real, you know, heroic black people who act like people. And I thought it kind of fed into the same stereotypes of black people being violent and savage. And like, especially some of the words used to describe Huey Newton and others, which was really, I thought, deeply racist.
Well, yeah, I've never really thought about that, but I think that at that time, in that context, when coming out of the years of the struggle of the civil rights movement, which was very decorous, very controlled, very effective, by the way, there emerged this much more sort of proud and assertive sort of sub-movements among the Panthers.
Black Power.
The Black Power movement,
Stokely
right?
Carmichael, SNCC versus
Yeah,
Martin
there were a
King.
Number of different groups. The Panthers were maybe the most well-known. And it was very impressive, and it was also very romantic. And I think in a historical sense, I think it is something that probably felt necessary for a lot of black activists to really assert that.
Oh, it's a great debate. That's the continuation of the Du Bois versus Booker T. Washington debate, which isn't necessarily even totally contradictory all the time. All I meant is that white people were kind of choosing sides and like making fun of Martin Luther King as not being a true black leader revolutionary. One guy, Donald, I forget his name, white professor at Yale, who wrote about the Panthers in New Haven, called the people who support Martin Luther King the infantile or the adolescent, and Huey Newton was the mature, true black. And that just, it's just outrageously obscene when you think about Martin Luther King, the people who risked their lives and their bravery and the change they brought. And, you know, to take sides in that debate and decide who are the genuine ones, I think that was just deeply racist.
Well, the racist thing was our decision to, like, literally pass a resolution at a conference naming the Panther Black Panther Party as the vanguard of the revolution, when the whole thing that had been going on with the emergence of black power and black separatism was white people stop telling us who and what to do. I mean, I think the Panthers actually liked being anointed, you know, because that was their own limitation.
And they were good also raising money that way.
Yeah, sure.
And we're talking about the when the 60s turned violent, in a book called Swords in the Hand of Children, Reflexes of an American Revolutionary, Jonathan Lerner, he's published a book, it's new, and it's quite interesting about his time in the Weather Underground. You know, one thing that really came across to me in your book about what motivates people when they get caught up in the romantic revolutionary movements and get them coming from such good motives and get them, take them to a place they wish they didn't go. You were talking about the role of not being able to question because you want to be part of the group and your friends. How did that work out in your case? Where did you find yourself doing things you didn't believe because you were scared of not being in the group anymore?
Well, almost constantly, actually. You know, I'm basically a pretty peaceable person. Like, so the whole idea that I would be so centrally involved in this very provocative and combative milieu was kind of weird. But I followed close friends into this because I wanted to be with them. I wanted their validation. There's another subtext here, which is that I'm gay. This all happened in the late 60s. In fact, the Stonewall Riot, and which is sort of considered the eruption, the emergence of gay liberation, happened at exactly the same time in June of 1969 that Weatherman formed. And I was completely aware of it. And a lot of other gay people who had been in SDS looked at Stonewall and the newly emerging gay organizations and said, wow, I can be a radical and also be an integrated person myself. I can come out and do this, and here's a forum I can do it in. I took a different path.
Did you ever think of being involved in the gay rights movement?
I didn't really think of it at the time.
Why not?
And because it didn't seem as valid to me. And I think the reason it didn't, well, there's two reasons. One is coming out is hard. It was harder then.
And had you, at what point had you come out?
I hadn't, I mean, some very close friends thought I was bisexual because that's what I told them, but knew I was into men. I didn't come out until many years later, actually. That's how hard coming out is. I was 42 years old when I came out.
Wow.
And so for me, sort of swallowing my own doubts and going along with this sort of increasingly disconnected and isolated and kind of delusional pathway of being in Weatherman was a way for me to hide, actually. It was a way for me to put on this kind of uniform and armor and costume of a street fighter when really I'm not a fighter. And ironically, the role I had allowed me to not be a fighter and yet to still wear that uniform. I was one of the people who gave press conferences. I wrote a lot of our literature. I gave voice to a lot of it.
And you weren't giving voice to what was deepest inside you.
I wasn't. And so that wasn't very authentic of me, was it? That's another lesson.
I don't mean to criticize. I've always been happy that I'm 10 years younger than you. Because if I had been coming of age when you came of age, I would have done so many things I'm embarrassed about that I don't think I could live with.
Well, the opportunities...
I did a lot of that later, but the times had changed, so you couldn't do as much damage.
The opportunities to make mistakes were
legion.
Available.
Which they are now.
And they're always available.
So the Weathermen were famous for their orgies. They were smashing monogamy. The idea is that we're going to pressure other people in the group to make sure they weren't tied by bourgeois restrictions like monogamy. So everybody was supposed to have sex with each other, which meant that you had sex with men and women, right, including
yes.
Bill Ayers. And how did that play into your closeted homosexuality?
Well, it allowed me to validate this idea, or to argue for this idea that I was actually bisexual, which was seemed to be a lesser. To be bisexual in those days seemed to be kind of intriguing and exotic, whereas to be gay in those days still
was it seen as weak? Was a gay male seen as not a real man?
I mean, that was the general concept in the society, and I think that was within us too, including within me.
And what happened with the attitudes toward the Weatherman? How did they view people who were, the Weatherman specifically, how did they view people who were gay, not bisexual, gay?
Generally, with a kind of belittling shrug.
Including in Weatherman.
Yeah, it wasn't, gay people weren't harassed for being gay. I think they were not taken, when it was known that someone was gay, they weren't taken quite as seriously.
And yet there was this great gay nights movement, not just with Stonewall, but the feminist movement, the new wave of feminism at the time, exposing a lot of the sexism in radical movements, the great takeover of RAT by women at the Underground paper in New York with Robin Morgan, and that for the first time in the feminist movement, they also embraced lesbianism as an out front part of the movement, going against Betty Friedan, trying to keep them out, and now. And you said that you watched some of this from afar. How did the role, because you've touched on this in the book, how did the emerging feminism and the questioning within the movement of patriarchy and male dominance play into all that?
Well, it was one of the, possibly the biggest thing that Weatherman got wrong and didn't understand. Central to our politics were some really important things that are still true. We really understood that racism was the core of American history. We really understood the follies of being involved militarily in other countries and involved in the civil wars of other countries. We didn't get it about women and about feminism or about gay liberation.
Most of us didn't.
Well, right, and we really didn't. And so, for example, you mentioned the smashing monogamy campaign that happened inside the organization. It was this kind of twisted misunderstanding of something that makes sense in feminism, which is a critique of these patriarchal relationships, and it was put forth as this idea that anybody who were couples, the couple should be split up, because then the boyfriends wouldn't be able to oppress the girlfriends. But what it actually allowed to happen was that the kind of macho, self-confident male leaders were able to have sex with any of the women that they wanted.
And you quote people saying, picking out, saying, hey, join the weathermen. The guy would say, another guy, you can have sex with her, her, and her.
Yeah, this is true.
My favorite moment in the Black Panthers was, even though they were macho like all the other groups, not just radical groups in society, they had a great feminist contingent. And Erica Huggins challenged Huey Newton and said on this very question, why is it you get to have sex with everyone you want, and the women are supposed to do that, but we don't get to have sex with whoever we want? And she convinced them. And that actually changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was kind of
interesting. Well, it didn't change in Weathermen.
I'm not saying it changed everything in the Panthers, but I thought that was kind of interesting. We're talking about the 60s, about violence and politics and social change with Jonathan Lerner, who has a very interesting new book out called Swords in the Hands of Children, Reflections of an Armed American Revolutionary. I think your book brought me back to the topic. I think about so much about how politics can be like religion, which can be like cults. And I don't see political group and being in a political movement as any different being a religious movement. They're both ways of trying to find a coherent explanation for how we live and why we live and how we should live, and connect us to other people who might be similar to us so that we have community.
Well, all of those are great motivations.
But it can go south.
Well, this comes back to the thing I said about the importance of thinking critically about what you're doing and why are you joining this particular
And how do you get all in without becoming a member of a cult who can no longer think critically and independently? How do you still be part of it? Because you have to accept a lot. Like when you join a religion, when I became observant Jew, or when you join a political group, you sometimes feel like you have to not speak out when you don't agree with something. Or you say, I'm just not going to agree with all of it, but I might do things like circumcise my kid or...
Well, I think that's a viable option. I'm not going to agree with all of it. I'm going to work with you guys in this group for this goal, but I'm not going
to... It's a human need to belong. As you guys, because one of the great parts of your book is when you come back from Cuba, you got sent to Cuba for the Weathermen, and then you felt disconnected, and you thought they'd forgotten about you, and they didn't want you back in the group, and you were kind of desperate. When in truth, they hadn't reached you when you came back to Canada.
We were out of touch with
them. And then you came back when they really, the last dregs of the Weathermen, when they had this ridiculous organizing projects, Prairie Fire, and yet you still bought all the stuff that you knew you weren't really organizing a revolution just so you could still be in the group.
Well, also by then I was 27, 28 years old, and the choice was to stay in this group where at least I knew the ropes, or to make my way as an individual person trying to be a grown-up.
And here's how you put this this question about thinking for yourself and cult. You said, this is from your book. You said, you wrote, the fallacy of ideological leftism, or any ideological ism, and I would throw in religion too, is to believe that an interpretation of the world's condition and a strategy for addressing it could possibly be perfect, all-encompassing, capable of being articulated at one moment and remaining apt over time. The world is too complex and irrational to be intellectualized and reduced like that. Believe that can be at once an expression of arrogance and a mask for the fear of weakness, a refusal to acknowledge the truth that our abilities to understand and act are limited, pitifully so. But we were young in 1969. It is in the nature of youth to be idealistic, but also at times arrogant. Those traits can get things done, but they can also mislead. Would you have been able to write that in 1989 when you first tried to write this book?
Not clearly, no.
So let's bring it to today. Well, before we get to today, your life took a turn. You talk about that. You came out as gay. You embraced the culture. What happened to you in the arena? How did you find footing in your life to move on from the Weather Underground and not live a cultish life of self-denial?
It wasn't easy, actually. It took a long time. For about a dozen years after I left the Weather Underground, when the organization was breaking up, I became a traveling antiques dealer living on the coast of Florida. It was sort of as far away geographically.
Was that in the book?
No, the book stopped sort of at the end of Weatherman. Yeah. But in other words, I went as sort of as far away geographically and also culturally as I could get. And I was living in a very isolated kind of context, traveling around to different cities doing antique shows. So I didn't have really like a community or social connections. And that I lived that way for 12 years or so until I finally decided I wanted to be part of something. And I moved to a city, Atlanta, that had a big gay community. And that's when I came out, actually, when I was 42 years old.
Wow.
but it was, you know, it took a lot of, it took many years before I didn't react to things still with that kind of knee-jerk, superior, radical, you know, I would see something happening in the news, or I would hear someone say something, And that kind of dismissive, self-important attitude that comes from adhering to an ideology and being committed to it in a cult-like way.
You wrote in the book, the fear and shame of being gay and seeing no way out of the closet can propel a person to make regrettable choices. And you lived that in the 1960s when so much else was going on. Let's talk about 2018, the centrality of LGBT movement. How did that happen that all of a sudden, because if you were coming of age now, you would be out of the closet, wouldn't you be?
I think so, yeah.
And could you have dreamed that back then, that society moved like that fast?
No. Actually, as a matter of fact, when gay activists 15 or 20 years ago started organizing to legalize gay marriage, I thought, wow, this is a really terrible idea. This is just going to drive a wedge between the liberals and the conservatives. It's going to be used as an issue to beat us
up with.
Because
we're older, and we didn't believe society can move that fast.
That's right.
But young people know it can, which is one of the advantages of youth.
It is. And also, it's one of the interesting things about this society, that it is actually flexible and resilient. You know, who cares about homosexuality now? A tiny number of rabid people.
Even younger evangelicals don't care.
No, they don't care. It's like, you know, fine. You know, guys in the army don't care about being, you know, of course, there are like individual confrontations that people have to make with their own preconceived ideas. But as a society, that's really changed. It's transformed. And I would never have imagined it could happen.
Jonathan Lerner, now you're living in Hudson, New York. Beautiful place to live. And you're a writer, correct?
Yes.
And you're married.
Yes.
How is your life now?
My life is very good. I'm not much of an activist, actually. I write about cities and environmental issues and how built places and unbuilt places relate to each other. And I consider that my political work, really, just trying to explain these important and complicated ideas in a way that make them accessible to people. I'm very happy being married. The people who I know in Hudson, when the book came out a few months ago, I was constantly being accosted by people on the street saying, we had no idea, you know, this is, you know, it's a completely, seems totally out of the box that I had this history. And my joke about it is, well, I'm very good at keeping secrets, but actually it's not that I've been keeping secrets. It's just, why would I bring it up? It was, you know, I'm in a different, totally different space.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up in a book, because a lot we can learn from it. You found your voice, you found your home. I'm so glad you did.
Thank you.
And I'm so glad that you were willing to then go back and try again to revisit this painful time in your life and in our country. Because there's a lot we can learn from it today in 2018.
Well, thanks for letting me talk about it, Paul.
Folks, the book is called Swords in the Hands of Children. And if you want to find it online to buy it, you can also just look up Jonathan Lerner. Either way, you're going to find it. And you can join and you can have the fun. I had the interest in reading that book. Thanks for joining us today on WNHH-FM's Dateline New Haven. Thanks to our guest, author Jonathan Lerner. And we're going to return in a few minutes with the Great Give Radiothon. That's the 36 hours that we spend every year in New Haven raising money for not-for-profits. As a community, we're aiming for $1.5 million a year for 488 groups. And here at WNHH, we've opened our studio except for this one-hour interlude. We're bringing in folks from all the groups to come on and tell us their story, why you should give them money. And they even recite a poem or sing a song, too, to tell us what inspires them. So hold tight, folks. We're going to be back at the noon hour with some more groups. We're going to be starting with James Sinclair from Orchestra New England. In the meantime, we're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. Now, we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book your flight with us all day and all night long here at WNHH. New Haven's home for community radio.